Every time that I read something about Nadav and Avihu, instead of getting more clarification, I get more mixed up. I was happy with the fact that you said at one point that they were so determined to have a maximum moment with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that they pushed the envelope and they knew that they might die. They deal with it like they... Moshe says to Aaron, I knew somebody was going to have to sanctify the Mishkan, I thought it was going to be me. And in these pieces that are here, they deal with them like people in heaven sang songs when they arose to heaven because they were so righteous. An injunction that if we're really righteous, we should push the envelope. It seems to me if somebody says, I want to live on the edge, then when it doesn't work out, somebody says, well, this is a person who wanted to live on the edge and fell off. And it's less tragic than if somebody had fallen off and they didn't want to live on the edge.
This is one of those things which is a lot like, we won't mention any names, but the paradox theory. You remember I told you the story about it was a Shabbos afternoon, and the doorbell rang. I answered the doorbell. I saw it was a young man who had recently moved to Milwaukee to join a practice of neurosurgeons. Anyway, this young man walks in, and he and his wife had joined one of the, then we had Orthodox Perspective groups. And he had joined an Orthodox Perspective group. It was a group that met once a month, and we talked about Jewish topics. So I was surprised because he married a girl from a very traditional home, and he himself had a, so I was very surprised that he came. He rang the bell and jumps. Anyway, that's very urgent, desperate. Okay. So he tells me that he just came from St. Joe's Hospital over here, and where he operated on a woman in her mid-30s, a wife, a mother, young children, and he ordinarily operates in a hospital that has equipment that's much more sophisticated. And over here, he was operating with less sophisticated equipment, and it was brain surgery. So he said that he was drilling, and because he didn't have the absolutely best equipment, so instead of being able to, when it was set the equipment so that it was gauged, he had to constantly drill, pull out the drill, drill a little bit more, pull out the drill, and it was when you're dealing with tiny fractions of distance. So on one occasion, he pulled out the drill, he realized that he had drilled a tad too far. But that the implications of having drilled over too far is that this woman was going to be paralyzed from the waist down. She would be incontinent. And, I mean, okay, it was a nightmare. Anyway, he'd finished the operation. And he came out where the husband was sitting in the waiting room. And he said to the husband, I have to tell you what just happened. And anyway, it was a scene. So he said, I'm just coming from that meeting with the husband, and I spent my whole life to reach this time in my life where I would be doing neurosurgery. He said, I really have to quit. I can't live with myself. I can't. He was a little bit suicidal with them. On the other, that was the extension of that. So we spoke for a while, and I got him a little bit of perspective on it, and we spoke thereafter several times, but he went back to neurosurgery, and was a neurosurgeon here for many years, and he died, actually a relatively young man, in his mid-50s, and left a young family. But he had a distinguished career. He was very, maybe this is more typical than it's atypical, but he told me on numerous occasions that when he came home to relax, he would take out a book on neurosurgery. That was how he relaxed. I mean, he had no other interest in life. No avocations. He could not do anything other than medicine. That was it. And he was totally obsessed by medicine. So, and he told me about it. He said that there was not really much that he could do about it. He had never developed any other interest. That was, this was his only interest in life. And this is what he did well at. This was what he had spare time, what he felt good doing. So, here you have a fellow who worked all of his life. I mean, literally, he was in his, probably his mid-30s by the time he finished his last residency. And it was a career which actually helped thousands of people. But it was a career where if you made a mistake by a hair's breadth, you could paralyze somebody. So somebody could argue, you know, so who asks you to live next to the edge? Only next to the edge. But when you look at power, you realize that all power is next to the edge. The one thing in America, or maybe in the world, that could save us from this evil cabal of oil is nuclear energy. Right now. And of course, everybody's afraid of it. And with good cause. Because you're dealing with tolerances that are paper thin.
You only need one Chernobyl.
One Chernobyl. So you have a source of power which has the capacity, but it has healing capacity as well, but it has the capacity to sustain millions of people without fear of having to deal with literally people who are wicked, exploited people, not to speak of what it does to our economy. That's the nature of real power. The nature of real power is that it's very, very fragile, very sensitive, very delicate. The levels of tolerance are very... the levels of tolerance are very thin.
The flip side being catastrophe.
Yeah, usually. People in positions of great power, if they make the wrong decision, it may appear to be a very subtle wrong decision at the time, but the ramifications of that decision could affect all of history, and it has affected all of history. Sometimes some very... what appeared to be rather innocuous kind of decisions kind of roll across history. It's like that expression that says every avalanche begins with one snowflake that says if I move it won't make a difference. People like Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen and Nadav and Abihu were people who had worked all their lives to achieve a closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the kind of thing that everybody wants, everybody aspires to. And the paradox is that you're supposed to aspire and you're supposed to want to get to that point. It is the crowning achievement of the person's efforts, but when you get there, the tolerance is very, very delicate. Because you place yourself in a relationship where if you err, if you make a tiny mistake, it's a massive mistake. If you make a mistake in your backyard with throwing something, it's a limited exposure to damage that you do. But if you happen to be playing someplace where there's lots of volatile substances, you throw it too far, you throw it too far. So that's not to say that the Rabbeinu Shlomo doesn't overlook him, it's not compassionate. It's a mindfulness of what a tiny departure means in the presence of awesome sanctity. You know, there's a rather remarkable story about a Kabbalist before the time of the Ari HaKadosh. And he and his disciples were determined that the misery and suffering of Israel needed to end and that they had to bring Mashiach. He was a massive, massive Kabbalist. So he assembled his finest Talmidim. I can't even remember. I read this some sefer probably 35 years ago, maybe more. And it was a very gripping story. Anyway, he assembled a group of his greatest Talmidim. They were saintly people, all of them. And he mapped out for them how they were going to bring Mashiach, and involved the fact that they were going to, all of them, they were going to go together into places of solitude, and there would be fast. And then, when they had gone through the period of preparation and immersion, voice and mayonites, all kinds of stuff, so then they were going to start focusing on certain divine names, which would take them progressively into supernal territory, which would open their access to the source of evil in the world, and would enable them, by virtue of the fact that they were going to be armed with the divine presence, to take the Satan captive, bring him to the divine throne, where the Almighty would end its existence. And he impressed upon them how dangerous this mission was, and how the tiniest error would end in catastrophe for them. And they were all, because they were all very dedicated to the well-being of Holy Israel, they all dedicated themselves to this thing. And they went through challenge after challenge, and barrier after barrier, until they finally came to the Sultan himself. And because of the fact that they were armed with the divine name, they took him captive in chains, whatever those kinds of chains look like. And they are now leading him to the divine throne. They've overcome so many great risks and dangers that it's unbelievable. And their joy that their Geula is going to come, they're going to end the hegemony of evil. And they're singing the Semiras, and she's booking the Almighty. And the head, I forget what his name was holding a little pushka with the summit. And hails the summit. And the Satan says to him, he's captive, it's all over for him. He says, give me a little bit of that. Can I have a smell? Oops. That was it. He gave the sub, he allowed the sub to smell his persona. That was the end of it. It was them back to zero. They were, the Ria Kudj said that where those nishamas ended up, very, very grateful. He said, but where they ended up, because of the fact that they gave the sub some persona to smell. And it was an awesome thing to retrieve their nishamas, just to go after them. When you're dealing with power, a tiny, tiny little hair's breadth make a difference. And there's a pasuk, Svivav Nisav Amiyad, when you're in God's company, a hair's breadth. Oh, that's it. The tolerance is a hair's breadth. So on the one hand, that's where you want to be, and on the other hand, the tolerance in being there is microscopic. That's why when Moshe Rabbeinu said, Hanukkah, he said, I knew that this Mishkan was going to be sanctified by one of us. He said, but I suspect it would be either me or you or me. In terms of the spiritual station that we had reached, we were the most likely candidates, because we were closest to that source of that awesome power. And it would stand to reason that we would be the ones that would. But he said, another Navi demonstrated that they were, in a sense, even closer. Another Navi understood that this service was an extraordinarily spiritually powerful kind of a service. They knew that in this Ketores there was a Keshar, there was a closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that could only be achieved through the Ketores. When Korach wanted to get into this Ketores, and those 250 Doshis HaNeblos wanted to get into the Ketores, because they understood what's in the Ketores. So, I mean, we don't understand, but they understood that there was some extraordinary closeness between the bringer of the Ketores and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which Nadav and Avihu yearned for. This was a job. When Aaron HaKohen did it, and he did it at the right time and in the right way, so it was the commandment itself that protected him. if you don't have the commandment to protect you, so then you're completely exposed. I think maybe that here, obviously, we're going into a place that we don't understand. So the only thing I can think of is that there was, on the one hand, there was this profound yearning to experience the closeness that Keturah could bring, the sense that, in a certain sense, that God might overlook in someone's chutzpah, whatever it is, but the fact that this was initiated by themselves in their desire to draw close, taking them into this very awesome place, and that there was the possibility that the Almighty would affirm their right to this closeness, and that they would live. Here's another very, very sensitive place of paradise. On the one hand, we are created, our essence is to be the beneficiary of God's goodness, of God's perfection. We had nothing to do with it. This was God's decree that there be a beneficiary for his goodness, which means that our essence is to receive that goodness. So on the one hand, what we're all about is experiencing God's goodness. One of the ways in which that is easily corrupted, and one of the ways in which it is constantly corrupted, is that we seek pleasure. Only we seek pleasures that are not of that variety, because since where the essence of us is to experience pleasure, so we go for the more immediate kind, we go for the kinds that are more appealing to us on a basis that we understand. So there's one part of us that is where our entire essence and existence is to receive pleasure, and on the other hand, one of the levels that we're supposed to reach is to serve God unselfishly, without making ourselves the reason that we're doing this. So we are in a very peculiar place, because what we are and what God wants us to be is the beneficiaries of his goodness. The only way to resolve this paradox is to recognize that the only pure way, unselfish way of receiving God's goodness is to receive it because God wants it, not because we want it. Then the reason that we do the things that we do in order to benefit from God's desire to confer upon us this reward is because of our recognition that it gives God, in a certain sense, it gives God pleasure to do so. The difference is that when I seek my pleasure, then I'm serving myself. And when I receive pleasure from God because this is God's will, and it being God's will, I want to do it in what pleases God, is that my receiving of pleasure in that context is unselfish. If I'm not serving myself, I'm serving the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And the Maral, really, when you see him get down to it, he says that after Jews proclaim Nasir Nishma, we'll do and we'll listen, that afterwards God hung the mountain over their heads. Mm-hmm. So what do you have to do that for? You know, we already volunteered. So the point, he says, is that even though God is doing this all for our sake, he wants us to know that we have to do it because he insists. In other words, that we could say, you know what, thank you, but no thank you. And I have some other interests. God says, no, you have to accept this good because I want you to accept the good, not because you want to accept the good. Mm-hmm. We're all, and to some extent, we're all stuck on this paradox because we can't afford to arrest our growth. We can't afford to invite mediocrity or complacency into our lives because we have to set as the standard for ourselves excellence, knowing that with excellence comes additional responsibility and accountability, none of which parenthetically should, even though as we grow we become more and more accountable, and even though with that accountability comes the consequences of being, of dealing with lapses. The lapses and the consequences are ordinarily, almost every instance, are limited, and the things that we have grown to become are forever. So we need to go where a hair's breadth makes a difference. And if we make a mistake in the place where hair's breadth makes a difference, so we'll be accountable for that mistake. And Nadav and Avihu were accountable. Nadav and Avihu's eternity was an eternity that was consistent, commensurate with who they were. And then you got the Zohar. The Zohar says that Nadav and Avihu joined the Neshama of Pinchas when he went to do his act of zealotry. It was a moment when he was so terrified that himself, what he was doing, because he was in grave danger, that he, in fact, his soul left him. And at that point, he was open, and the neshamas of Nadav and Avihu joined him. And eventually, as the Gemara says, Pinchas Elio, and this was metamorphosized into, as I said, morphed into the prophet Elijah, who never died. And as the harbinger of Gula. So there's Nadav and Avihu. Made a mistake, and it was a painful mistake, but the fact is that there were Nadav and Avihu, and Nadav and Avihu had this impact on Jewish history. What the Chazal are looking for is there has to be this, you know, this little niche, this little nick, which is responsible for either for the way they processed the decision or who they were when they got in there. Were it not for this something, there has to be something where they erred. In the sheer longing itself, if the longing was, if there was an ego part of it, then that would have been sufficient. Not traveling the regular road, but
right,
trying to shortcut it. Right. Everybody, the Rabban Shalom is a quintessentially just judge. So everybody's judged according to who they are, where they are, when it is, you know, everything.